Mark, I found your CV. It was appended to Bill Brandt's. You're best known, though. You left this out, and it really is very important. You represented the beneficiaries in the Isaac Stern will contest for squandering his legacy.
Yeah, I represented his kids against their
exemption. Wow, that was something.
You got to watch the third or fourth wife.
Ooh.
I got that? I don't think you're up to four yet.
I'm not up to four yet. Okay.
We have our Obama teleprompter.
Yeah. Well, one area where we are seeing an uptick. Oh, by the way, in connection with that last panel, the recipient, Jay Golden, the recipient of the award at lunch, is New York Times referred to him as the man who saved New York from bankruptcy. He was the comptroller of the city of New York during the 70s, when Gerald Ford was supposed to have said, but never said, dropped dead to New York. But New York, I don't think this is what Jay's going to talk about at lunch today, but he was the guy, who took New York and was able to maintain solvency, which ties in with what Bill Brandt said, is that, you know, you hear about the Harrisburgs and the Jefferson counties, but you didn't hear about a New York Chapter 9 because there never was one. The energy opportunities out there seem to be a lot, and I'm not just talking about coal. And our next panelists are uniquely situated to talk about this. Robin Russell is the managing partner of Houston's Andrews Kurth's office in Houston. She has actual experience in this area in the Reverly Resources case, Trico, Bigler, and several others. Her partner, Paul Silverstein, in addition, in the New York office of a firm, represented the sub-debt and Dynergy and Fairpoint Communications, the Creditors Committee, Pilgrim's Pride, the Creditors Committee, and a number of other cases that are familiar to us all. Tara Jan is a managing director with Jefferies. You've seen a lot more of Jefferies in this energy sector since they acquired Randall and Dewey, I guess 6 or 7 years ago, and they have a real presence in investment banking in this sector. Tara was in the Baytown Navigation Chapter 11 case, Beryl Oil, among others. I have recently heard someone, in tying into what Steve Gittemall said this morning, I recently heard somebody in Houston say that the recent election results were the worst thing to happen to the oil patch since Appomattox Courthouse. So your thoughts.
Good morning. Here's our clicker.
You have a clicker? I went dead without a clicker. Thank you.
Well, the topic of energy covers a lot of ground, and we're going to divide this up into what we call the green energy businesses, solar, wind, hydro, and biofuels, and the traditional oil, gas, LNG, and coal, with the focus being more on the E&P companies, because that's where we're seeing the most activity in bankruptcy right now. There is definitely a green energy graveyard. Overall, there are more winners than losers, the winners being wind, and wind power projects are doing well. The loser in the graveyard is definitely solar, with the subsidies that are going on in Europe to the European solar panel makers. The U.S. Solar companies have had a hard time, even with all the money that the government has put into them.
And what we're seeing, obviously, from a restructuring perspective is that there are not that many opportunities for restructuring professionals within the solar sector, given the fact that a vast majority of the restructurings have effectively been liquidations, given the governmental subsidies in both Europe and China.
The real focus is on what's happening with oil and gas prices.
And I think one of the things that, you know, we'll talk about in some specifics when we go through our slides, but one of the things that people always focus on from an investor perspective is looking at the long-term averages on oil and gas pricing. And you can see today that natural gas pricing is very low compared to the long-term average of the 5-year we're showing here, although it has ticked up a little bit. But I think what you also see is when you look at the next slide is a very interesting fact that for those of you who are focused on oil and gas will know very well, which is that there is really a split that has occurred between a divergence that's occurred between what used to be a correlation, a very close correlation between oil pricing and natural gas pricing. Even 3-4 years ago when people were doing models from a restructuring perspective and looking at, you know, how do I look at this company on a long-term basis, there's always a correlation that was used between oil pricing and natural gas pricing for future production. But what has now happened, in particular because of the development of the shales, is that there's significantly more natural gas supply, which is impacting many of the investment decisions that were made earlier in terms of acquisition of properties for the development of those opportunities. And, you know, the distinction between oil and natural gas is, of course, that natural gas is very much less transferable. It's much more of a regional commodity versus oil, which is a global commodity that can be easily transported. And what we're showing here is natural gas pricing in the U.S. If you were to look at this in Europe, it would be a multiple of this in pricing. But, you know, many of the opportunities we're looking at here and this discussion will be focused on U.S. natural gas and oil production. And the reality of this economic of low natural gas pricing and the divergence from oil is probably something that's going to stick around for a while.
You don't see gas going up?
I don't see gas going up in the near term, given just the incredible amount of investment that has been put into development of these properties, both in the acquisition of them and, you know, frankly, in certain situations that we'll talk about a little bit later. It's not just the acquisition of properties, but it's the acquisition of the right to develop properties, and the right to develop properties creates significant pressure on producers to and E&P companies in general to continue with the exploration for the sole purpose of holding on to those leases in the hopes that the long-term cycle of pricing comes up.
When we talk about the energy industry, it's broken down in three sectors: the upstream, the midstream, and the downstream. The upstream being the E&P, and that's where we're seeing the most activity in bankruptcy. But the midstream, now, but as we may discuss later on, it's coming probably to midstream and downstream at some point.
And the other point I would just make on this is, you know, when we look at sectors like this from a restructuring perspective, you know, in some sense, you look at E&P very closely, but when you think about cycle dynamics, at the end of the day, it's generally the service companies that probably get hit the quickest. So service companies within the E&P sector when there's a downturn, given the fact that you know, they probably don't have the benefit of hedging. They are simply a third-party provider of services that...
Without assets.
And they're a third-party provider of services that when things get challenging for E&P companies, they will try to do in-house as quickly as possible to save costs.
We see in pipeline a lot of activity as people are building into North Dakota and other places where shale is prevalent in order to get product out. In marine transportation, we see a lot of activity in bankruptcy. The shipping industry has had a lot of filings. Most recently, the Overseas Shipping Group up in Delaware. Downstream refineries, we'll talk later about Bigler and some of the other refineries that have filed recently. Looking at the energy supply chain, it takes us through each one of these steps. And so let's focus on the types of E&P assets and liabilities that we see in these bankruptcies.
And here you can see a list of some of the assets and liabilities. And I think, you know, one of the things when we thought about what to talk about in this panel we discussed was we're all restructuring professionals. We look at restructuring clients or prospective clients through many of our own different analyses. One of the things that from a financial perspective I spent a lot of time on is looking at financial statements of companies to identify specific triggering events that could lead to a restructuring or a need for covenant relief. And while that kind of analysis goes across the board, regardless of the type of company you're looking at, when it comes specific to E&P companies, there are some very interesting nuances that I think one needs to focus on, and we typically look at, that goes beyond what you would naturally look at or conclude off of when you look at the financial statements of another type of company that's not an E&P company.
As Tara mentioned, in the E&P industry, it is definitely a drill or die. In order to keep these leases operative, there has to be exploration and production.
And so looking at E&P companies, I think as just a general basis, if I were to look at a company from a potential restructuring candidate, I'd look at a number of factors. But let's just focus on a few for this discussion. One would be leverage. Second would be cash flow. A third would be, where would my investment sit from an absolute priority perspective? Fourth would be, what is the liquidity profile of that company? And a fifth would be, if I make an investment, how can I ever monetize? Or what is the likelihood of my monetization of that investment? And how does the balance sheet and the financial statements help me determine the likelihood of being able to do that? And so the first one, you know, and this is a little bit of an underlying theme to all of them.
Let's just make clear that each of these examples are misconceptions or
right.
Yes. Yeah, so these
going
are
back to five misconceptions. So misconception number one.
We're going to talk a little bit about, you know,
so
misconceptions.
If you get this wrong, you're going to mess up in investing. These are what you shouldn't do.
Exactly. So we're going to talk about a little bit about, you know, these unique ways to look at E&P companies and the misconceptions you could have if you make the wrong conclusions off the, you know, the macro data, so to speak. And the first one's a theme that goes through the other examples, but we focus this one simply on the leverage component. And many times when you look at from an investing perspective at a company and you see low leverage and you see an opportunity to provide secure debt at a low price, it's probably looks like a very good investment. You typically have good, you know, if you're secured, you're secure with obvious benefits. Low pricing is helpful in a low yield environment, generally. And you probably feel pretty good about that investment. And a lot of times also when we look at from our own perspective at potential restructuring candidates, we focus on leverage. And so if you have leverage that's five and above, that may mean, depending on how active leverage finance markets are, someone who could not refinance. But when it comes to E&P companies, in fact, leverage can be a very big misnomer. And in the case of this example, you know, is 3x and 60-cent paper a very good buy? Really depends on a number of underlying facts that you need to investigate.
But isn't your point that being levered 3x and debt trading at 60 is not a no-brainer by any means?
That's right. It's by no – exactly right. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, leverage can be very misleading because in part, especially with E&P companies, you know, cash flows can have a very finite life. And the reason the cash flows can have a very finite life is that it really depends on the underlying collateral that's generating that cash flow. If you have operations, for example, in shallow waters of the Gulf, the life of those wells can be no more than 1 or 2 years before you start to see steep declines in production. And what that means is that, in fact, to continue to generate that type of a cash flow, there's a very meaningful reinvestment of capital that needs to be put into place. And that reinvestment if not taken into consideration when you're looking at EBITDA, can overstate or understate leverage meaningfully. But there's other components when it comes to E&P companies and that cash flow and that leverage that one needs to consider. So one is reinvestment. The other is, you know, what is required outside of capital spending for the continuation or maintenance, that type of cash flows. Well, again, if you're an offshore producer, you may very likely have bonding requirements for plugging and abandonment, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And you could also have very meaningful insurance requirements. And you know, many times when you look at opportunities at 3x levered for something trading at 60, you're probably looking at a pretty small company. Pretty small companies usually can't afford to self-insure. And so that is another meaningful leakage in cash flows that need to be in that equation of what is my true leverage. My true leverage is not just my EBITDA, not just a reflection of EBITDA, but it's EBITDA plus sustainable CapEx, plus insurance obligations. The other distinction that comes with leverage in E&P companies is the fact that, you know, you have this distinction effectively between asset values and cash flows. The other way to look at E&P companies is to look at, you know, what is my true value of my reserves. But not all reserves are equal. You can see here we've outlined the main categories of reserves between proved developed producing, proved developed not producing, and proved undeveloped. People weigh these very differently, and in fact they get weighed very differently also where you are within the cycle of pricing. And that distinction between the value of those assets, you could have great collateral but no cash flow, also will impact, you know, very much your investment and how good that investment is at 60 cents and 3x.
And we're seeing in a lot of these E&P cases that, as would be expected, equity is coming forward and trying to put a significant value on probable and possible reserves, which may put them into the money.
And which may cause some very interesting and not so unique valuation fights if people have the gumption for that.
This happened in the H&M bankruptcy in Dallas about 2 weeks ago in connection with the lift stay motion. We're still waiting on that valuation to come forward. And in ATP, the judge has allowed the formation of an equity committee on a contingent fee basis to see if there's possibly something left there for equity.
And nothing about ATP. Tiro, Jeffries has nothing to talk about that because there is a case.
Right, and Andrew Kurth is as well. So ATP, we're just telling you what's in the public domain.
That won't stop us.
The other thing I just mentioned on this point is that, you know, when I say when we say here geographic location matters, that's really a reference to the fact that, you know, when I mentioned things like bonding requirements for plugging and abandonment and insurance, I'm really talking about your wells operating in the Gulf have very different dynamics that need to be dealt with because of hurricanes, because of environmental issues, than if operations would be onshore, where you may not have the same acute needs that could arise for cash that need to be incorporated into your investment decision. And again, when does insurance needs or bonding needs become most relevant? It's probably when the company is distressed. And so, you know, if you're looking at financial statements before the distress, you may not notice that kind of potential obligation unless you really dig deep.
So misconception number two.
Misconception number two goes back to the second main point of cash flows, and not all cash flows are equal. You know, when you go back to that earlier slide and see how much natural gas pricing has fluctuated and ultimately come down, one of the issues that happens with E&P companies is that many of them for a number of years had been able to hedge pricing and get some benefit from hedging to effectively protect against downside of pricing. What that masks is what is really the underlying cost of drilling, and is that drilling economic if hedging is not available? Now, hedging probably becomes least available when you most need it. So tripping a covenant or showing any type of financial distress maybe the most likely time you may lose that type of hedging protection. And one of the interesting things when it comes to hedging also is to understand who the counterparty that hedging is. For example, if the same party that's providing your revolver is also providing hedging, and you have a revolver issue in terms of their view of your collateral, you know, you may have a double liquidity problem that, again, the financial statements by themselves may have not at first glance shown you.
Misconception number three.
The third one is a very important one, and this comes to play a lot in EMP cases and is often ignored by a lot of investors. And that is that, look, not all accounts payable are equal. And it goes back to the basic premise of, if I'm investing in secured debt, do I really need to look at junior creditors? And do junior creditors really matter? Well, in the case of EMP companies, they matter a lot, especially if your operations are in Texas or Oklahoma.
Looking for a minute at Texas. Texas has, as an oil and gas state, a very broad mechanics and material liens provision for mineral properties. So these are statutory liens that come ahead of bank debt, anything secured, to persons performing services or providing materials in the oil and gas industry. Mineral activities is defined very broadly. Digging, drilling, torpedoing, operating, completing, maintaining, or repairing an oil and gas or water well, an oil and gas pipeline, or a mine and quarry. One of the most bizarre cases allowed a catering company who provided food to the drill site to have a material and mechanics lien for the value of the food. Comes straight ahead of the bank. So these liens are broad. They cover all the wells on the lease, not just the well for which the materials or services are provided. So it can cover a large area. It can even go beyond the particular lease that that well is on if there is additional acreage that is operated as a unit. So in Texas, and there's an Oklahoma statute very similar, these can cover virtually everything operated within a unit, and liens come ahead of the bank.
And Robin, how have bankruptcy courts outside of Texas recognized the Texas and Oklahoma?
Well, we're going to get to that a little bit later when we're going to talk about the lingering effects of SimCrude.
So, I mean, the only other point I'd make on this one is that, you know, as a restructuring professional, as I'm sure as a distressed debt investor, one of the things you're always taught to look at is absolute priority. You know, where do I invest my money, and where within the absolute priority would I, in a waterfall of recoveries, where would my investment shake out? And, you know, M&M liens are something that most people don't focus on when they make their investments, and can come really to be an unpleasant surprise at the end of the day in the restructuring.
I think most people know about them, but I think most people don't focus on the potential magnitude.
That's
of them.
Right. And look, I'll give the example of Crusader Energy, which is a 2009 restructuring that I worked on. In the ultimate restructuring, which is a plan structure, second lien debt holders who really had a very, very small revolver only on ahead of them, but the second lien secured lenders ended up with out-of-the-box recoveries of 68 cents, somewhere around 68 cents. M&M lien holders got 60 cents. So when that restructuring commenced, no one in that second lien thought that they were anything but, you know, fully secured, and certainly not, you know, subject to leakage of that magnitude before they were going to get, you know, 100% recoveries.
Misconception.
Yes, misconception. Also mentioned here are contracts in the oil and gas industry that may not be rejectable or may be subject to tremendous set-off rights. And we will talk in a few minutes about Lyondell and a specific situation there. But these types of things can impact the assets when they are trying to be sold or when you're trying to restructure the company.
impact meaningfully. I mean, they're effectively, in order to release the assets, these are liens that need to be satisfied. The fourth misconception we brought out here goes to the question of analyzing the liquidity of the business as part of the investment decision. And one of the things that, you know, we mentioned here is to say, well, if the company has, you know, a large revolver that's undrawn, it should be in a very good position and, you know, have the runway required for my investment to work out. And the misconception here is that, of course, it can be a very misleading perspective to simply look at the size of the undrawn revolver without looking at the underlying issues that may arise with a company hitting any type of a covenant breach. Companies within the E&P sector are typically subject to two-time-year redeterminations of their reserves by their secured revolving lenders. But in many instances, those redeterminations of the collateral value, the reserves, effectively the reserve reports, can also occur off schedule. And again, the most likely time when something occurs off schedule is when you least want it. When you really need the liquidity, you get an off-schedule check of your collateral. And the problem with that for a company is that it may be performing perfectly to budget. Management may have done everything correct, but you know the bank, the lender, may determine for whatever reason that it feels uncomfortable with the reserve base and can ratchet down that access to liquidity when you most need it. And as one of the themes of being an E&P company, everyone knows, is you effectively have to continue to drill. These are diminishing, depleting assets, and you need to continue to drill in order to maintain your collateral base and cash flows. And if you can't drill, you die. And one of the things you need for that is a meaningful amount of cash to do that. And so in order to really assess that true liquidity profile, the access to the undrawn revolver, one needs to look at some of the financial statements and see, for example, in the last few redeterminations, has the bank ratcheted down the availability? You know, what is the relationship between that lender and the company, and do you think that it will stay there as an ongoing partner for that business, even if things get troubling in the short term?
And how much discretion does the bank really have, though, in such redeterminations?
It generally has absolute discretion. It is the lender. One good example of that was in Crusader Energy, where, you know, in a matter of months, the availability in the beginning of 2009 under revolver went from 100 million to 25 million. It was in that instance that the debtor, who ultimately became a debtor, was 30 million drawn on the revolver, and effectively went into a shutdown mode in terms of access to liquidity to operate, and ultimately filed within several days.
And often the party here is not a traditional lender. It's someone who is very interested in the oil and gas play and is perfectly prepared to take over the assets in a foreclosure.
It can very much be an activist lender, but we've also seen instances where, you know, regional lenders who've decided to pare down their exposure to smaller credits have decided to exit certain long-term relationships, and they've done that through ratcheting down the availability through off-scheduled redeterminations.
So there can be a lot of motivations
Yes.
to do this.
The fifth misconception that we want to talk about was really, again, talking about the concept of how do I then ultimately, having made the investment, monetize my investment, and having bought into a relatively low, optically low leverage, you know, do I really need to consider other obligations on the balance sheet in that monetization process? Because I'm the secured lender and I bought in secured debt, and these other obligations effectively are classified as unsecured. And one of the main ones you see in offshore operators are plugging and abandonment obligations. What many people do is ignore this liability, but they ignore it at their own peril, because these are obligations that either need to be satisfied in any kind of a transfer of the assets, or need to be otherwise dealt with as part of the restructuring.
And that's largely because it's a somewhat regulated industry.
That's right. These are regulated, government-related obligations that just can't be ignored. If for example, one were to sell the business and not satisfy the P&A liability, the purchaser would have to assume it.
Maybe, or it's a negotiation.
No, they have to assume it in whole. And the government will likely look to that purchaser to be someone who they deem to be able to satisfy, notwithstanding just their ability to make the purchase price, but also to fund obligations that will come due over time through the P&A liability.
And did you see this in the Energy Partners case?
We weren't involved in Energy Partners, but I understand that this is a very large issue with the restructuring in Energy Partners.
The government bonding requirements virtually shut Energy Partners down, and one of the benefits of reorganization was that by cleaning up the balance sheet, the company became exempt again from the bonding.
Right. The other issue we wanted to just mention, and it relates really to the P&A as another one of these obligations that don't necessarily show up on the balance sheet, but is important for the analysis of monetizing one's investment. And these are overriding royalty interests and net profit interests that exist with certain E&P companies that are a peculiar, I think, and specific to the E&P sector. And you want to talk a little bit about them?
We're going to talk for a minute about ATP because this has become a big issue there. Tarot represents the debtor as the FA, and Andrews and Kurth represents the indenture trustee. So these are just public document-based statements that we're about to make. But a lawsuit has now been filed by persons who allege they are purchasers, and that's a big word here, purchasers of perpetual overriding royalty interest and net profit interest. They have filed a declaratory judgment action in the bankruptcy court in Houston asking the court to declare that those overriding royalty interest and net profit interests are not property of the estate, that there was an absolute pre-petition conveyance made to them, and that these are not executory contracts. This presents an interesting issue because typically under Texas law, these sorts of things would be property interests, but this has some unique aspects to it. Why don't you tell us about the term?
I think one of the things that's very interesting about overrides in general is that, again, if one is selling overrides, you know, you're effectively pre-selling your cash flows. And you as the operator may not have access, if you just look at your financial statements without much analysis, you may not have access to the cash flows you think you have because you've sold off interests. And you may not have the reserves you think you have because those reserves have been pledged to someone else. You've received money for them. But from a pure analysis of that financial statement, that may not be your overall underlying asset that you can monetize. And so when you've made your investment as a secured lender and you look at how do I monetize, again, it goes back to the question of absolute priority. It goes back to the question of what cash flow do I really have access to when I think about the reinvestment into the capital program on a go-forward basis, of operations. And, you know, I would make the point in ATP, it's very clear from the financials that having sold a significant amount of overrides pre-petition, post-petition, a lot of the debt that's being incurred through the DIP is really meant to help replenish the reserve basis that had been primarily sold off through these overrides pre-petition.
And these overrides were structured so that there was essentially a guaranteed return on them to the purchaser from ATP, and they were short-lived. So the issue in the litigation is similar to a true sale versus disguised financing. in the financial statements that ATP filed, these are categorized as financial transactions. And that is the issue that will be determined in Houston.
And I'm taking the bet on financing transactions.
Well, in Houston, that may be the case. We're not here to comment on the litigation, but let's talk about some other cases that we have seen in Houston recently. The theme for all of these is that these are depleting assets, and so there has to be in the reorganization a deleveraging so that there can be some cash flow to continue drilling lest they die. In Energy Partners, it was an equity swap. In Dune Energy, same thing. Most debt was swapped for equity. In Reveille, Guggenheim was the secured creditor. It ended up owning the company in Reveille. It did in Branta as well, although they did that outside of bankruptcy. And in Cano Petroleum, same thing.
And look, one of the other themes you see in these is that these are primarily Texas filings. And when you think about investing in an E&P credit, what you're probably looking at, to the extent there is a triggering event, is a more likely chance that that reorganization takes place in Texas than in Delaware or the Southern District of New York. The other thing I would just note, and I know we're running out of time, is that you know, when you look at reorganizations within the E&P sector, given the depleting nature of the assets, and you know, it's probably less likely that you see dips in place than you see in some of the other sectors, just given the nature of the collateral that exists.
There are definitely acquisition opportunities here, because a sale is what it's about, unless the lender is going to take the equity. 363 sales are very common. There's advantage to stocking horses. One thing we're seeing is a new trend in online auctions. We call it eBay for ONG. The Oil and Gas Asset Clearinghouse in Houston does online sales of oil and gas properties. This has become a very easy way, cuts down on a lot of expenses in bankruptcy, and bankruptcy courts have approved these auction agreements, which can be done with or without the operating agreements attached to them.
We're running short, so let's move forward to maybe Semcrude. Okay, I think Hugh Ray wants to join us on that one.
Are we out of time? Yep, we're out of time. Okay, well, we will leave Semcrude for another day. Thank you.